Welcome to In Conversation with David Goa. I titled this series of conversations with young people, The Love of Learning and the Desire for God. I met each person in this series while teaching at Newman Theological College in Edmonton from 2020, during the pandemic, through the fall of 2023. Newman had just introduced a new degree and moved its curriculum into a great books and Socratic dialogue model. I'm joined by Anna Sidlovsky in this podcast. Anna grew up in Saskatchewan, was largely homeschooled within an intentional community that formed the love of learning and the desire for God. How this community of learners was shaped is richly described by Anna. Its gifts and the ground superbly prepared her for what unfolded in her years with the great books at Newman Theological College. The first year, the year of COVID, was not easy, and she vowed not to return. But she did. And as you will hear, the maturing that occurred is at the center of all that is best in a liberal education. Welcome to our conversation. So Anna, I had the pleasure of meeting you in the classrooms at Newman Theological College. I remember how shocked I was, I'll confess to this, the first time I saw you in the hallway, and I asked you why you were studying at Newman. And you said to me, if I recall correctly, that you wanted to get a good Catholic education and formation so you could be a good wife and mother. And for someone of my age and my cultural world, this had never been heard in 50 years. So I was charmed by it, and then had the pleasure of being in class with you and getting a little glimpse of your very fine mind and your lovely heart. So can you tell me just a little bit about your early childhood? You know, I've had the pleasure now of reading two of your mother's Christmas letters, so that gives me a sense. She's like the Apostle Paul writing epistles. So you've had a very particular formation. Mm-hmm. Homeschooled to some extent, I think.
Yes.
And in a family that's very intentional. So can you just paint a little picture of that?
Mm-hmm. So I think I have the advantage in my family because I'm the oldest of knowing where our family has come from and where how we've developed. I started off, my parents were always very intentional, and homeschooling was an interest for Mom from the beginning. I know she went to a homeschool convention when I was a toddler.
Do you know where that convention was?
I don't. It could have been in Saskatoon or in Regina. But her was a school teacher. She was teaching French immersion. And so I think when it came time for me to start school, it was maybe a little bit of a conversation, but I don't know exactly what was discussed. I ended up going into the French immersion school where my mother taught. So my mom was my kindergarten teacher in the Catholic school. Mm-hmm. That was in our neighborhood.
And this is in Saskatoon?
This is in Saskatoon, yes. And I only had her for half the year because then she went on mat leave with the fourth child in our family. So I went to kindergarten, I went to grade one, and then I think that experience was enough for Mom and Dad to realize that they wanted to homeschool. It's not that anything really horrible happened at school, but I think they saw how exhausted I was at the end of every day and how, you know, my best time I gave to school and then the beautiful family life that we had had was reduced to, you know, fixing me after school because I was just so depleted.
I see.
And so...
So it had more to do with the rhythm.
With the rhythm,
yes. Of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotional cost
of mm-hmm. school.
Exactly. Yes. So, you know, prior to me being in school, and while I was in school too, honestly, we had developed a rhythm of a lot of family time and a lot of travel. We were caring for my great-grandparents in Weyburn, which is 3.5 or 4 hours away. And so we spent a lot of time there. Dad was working there to, you know, make it doable for us to be caregiving for my great-grandparents. And we would take trips to the States. We took a trip to the Northwest Territories. I missed so much school. And Dad didn't like the idea that just because I was in school, he now couldn't access his daughter.
Sensible father.
Yes. So that was, I think, a big motivation behind us homeschooling. And Mom had the interest. Like, she had had the interest from the beginning. And she had been doing the research, and she loved it. She loved Montessori, and she later developed, she later found classical education. That was primarily the model that we followed.
And she had gone to university and studied education?
Yes, yeah.
Where?
In Regina.
Regina?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And she had done a semester abroad, well, not abroad, in Quebec.
That's abroad.
And that's abroad. Yes. Mm-hmm. So she knew her way around a little. She says now that she's not sure to what extent her teaching education was helpful when she taught us at home. I'm sure it was helpful to some extent because she had the love of doing research, and she loved exploring different curricula, and she loved looking at different models of learning. But I think she had, because she had been a classroom teacher, then she had different expectations about how it would look when we did school at home, that it would look more like the classroom. Whereas now the model that she follows is that it's more like a continuation of her parenting, which I think is much healthier. And we have a formal aspect to our school as well. I think we follow a more formal, you know, structure and routine and things than a lot of families do. And yet it's still very much just integrated into our family life and what we do. And Dad is integrated into it. And it follows the family's needs. So there are seasons when we don't necessarily do school because we're working with Dad, things like that.
And your work with your father, that was another kind of education.
That was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Yes. So I think Mom and Dad rightly understand that they had something that they wanted to give to us. And the difficulty with me being in school was that I wasn't really available to receive that. And so there were sacrifices that Mom and Dad made early on, decisions, so that we could spend more time as a family and then receive what Mom and Dad had to teach us. And really know what they knew. So, for instance...
Yeah, what did they have to give you?
For instance, Dad quit his job, you know, working for other people, and he started his own business.
What had he been doing?
He had been working... I think he had been working as an electrician at a food processing plant.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, from that time on, he focused more on the rental business and on electrical work and general contracting. And so from the time we were very little, we were able to go work with Dad. And that started with working with him on our own projects, because those were the projects we were allowed to be on.
So when it came to hooking up the 222 electricity, he gave that to you, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, from the time we were 5, we would be on the construction site.
Ah.
And our job would be sweeping and cleaning,
right,
and hauling and learning the names of the tools,
yeah,
and trying to see what the next thing Dad would need before he realized he needed it and asked for it. You know, like just very intentional, careful teaching.
Classical apprenticeship.
Yeah.
This is how the medieval world was shaped.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that's a big part of what we learned from Dad. I mean, being in the rental business, I also was kind of always apprenticing under him as a landlord as well. So I always went to his rental meetings with him, and I'd be responsible for leases and filling things in. kind of getting a sense of people, even when I was, you know, it wasn't at the point for me to be making judgment calls on other people's characters and whether we would want to have them in Dad's hoses or not. But already I was seeing how he did it, which I loved doing.
You saw how he would negotiate with people, how he would explore and discover something about their character?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you were, this is how your childhood was shaped. Until what age?
It's ongoing.
It's ongoing. It remains that way.
It remains that way. Yeah. We still do projects as a family. Mm-hmm. Most recently, my siblings and I purchased a house in a small town near Saskatoon, and it was a renovation project. So the lovely thing about that was now the kids kind of took charge with Dad as a support rather than the other way around. So that was a beautiful experience for us to kind of see what we could do on our own. And Dad was fully supportive of us, so we had as much help as we needed.
But he didn't get in the way.
Well, I don't think he got in the way before either. But yeah, it was an opportunity for us to explore what we could figure out on our own.
I think I saw a photograph of you on a roof doing some shingling.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. Yes, that would have been with my uncle's roofing crew.
So, I mean, that's a kind of lovely form of initiation into construction and everything that goes on in that.
Yes, yeah.
Carpentry, electricity, window fitting.
Yeah, I had roofing. A pretty well-rounded experience of the construction world in terms of the different trades, just because we would do our own projects. There was a cabin that we built when I was probably... I don't know, I was probably 15 when we started, and it took us a few years. But we really took that. We bought it when it was at lockup stage, so windows and doors were in, the roof was on, and then we did everything with it from there. So, you know, that was our very much a start-to-finish type of project. We learned all the steps along the way. And then renovating, doing additions on our own homes or renovations in our own homes, you know, there's lots of finishing work and then roofing for about 7 summers, so a lot of roofing.
And your family's Catholic.
Yes.
And my impression is they take the faith seriously.
That's true, yes.
So what was the shape of that part of your spiritual formation?
Mm-hmm. It's developed over time. I think... the faith was important to Mom and Dad when they got married, but they had not received much formation as children or young adults. I remember my mother talking about how amazingly surprised and excited she was when she first heard someone mention that there was a catechism that contained written down the things that the Catholic Church believes and explains them a little bit.
Oh, I see.
And this was when my mom was in her earlier 20s, probably. So, you know, the formation was lacking for them, but somehow they knew it was important enough to pursue. So that was going on throughout my growing up. For them, one very foundational thing they'd had was Familia, which is a Regnum Christi program. There's a men's program and a women's program focusing on marriage and family life issues through reading papal encyclicals. So that was very formative for them, I think. And so, you know, they were always studying, talking to people. We began, in terms of our liturgical life, again, that's developed a lot. We began going to, I guess, a regular Novus Ordo parish. It was a small congregation. It was kind of dying. The congregation was very elderly.
In Saskatoon?
In Saskatoon, yes. It became difficult to go there because Dad found that on the way home, he would talk to us a little bit about what we had heard about Mass and try to, first of all, ascertain if we had picked up on what Father had been saying during the homily. And if not, that was fine. But if we had, then we would have discussions to kind of, you know, correct any misconceptions that might have been raised in our minds because we were not receiving perhaps fully Orthodox teaching.
So your father had had a perspective on the priests and homilies.
Indeed, yes.
And what should be emphasized.
Mm-hmm. Well, and just knew enough about church teaching to know where, you know, where our priest was diverging from that. So this was, we were there for many years. It was a beautiful community. We were so welcomed, I think, especially because there were a lot of cute children in my family. So, you know, we loved being there. And we moved to that parish because the community was so welcoming to us. Hmm. And we were there for many years with different priests along the way. But
my father did the same thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would walk home from church with him, and he would proceed to deconstruct the sermon of the priest, of the clergyman. And for part of that period, there were a couple of good pastors, but there was a sequence of them who were, I mean, it's really quite stunning when I think back on it, that they were given that position. They had some charismatic gifts, I think, so some people were attracted to them. But from a theological and biblical perspective, they were heretics. So my father would talk about this on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
And then on a couple of occasions, he would say that he knew where this text came from, that the minister had pretended to preach, but had really read.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go upstairs and take a book off the shelf of a 19th century
mm-hmm.
evangelical fundamentalist preacher
mm-hmm.
and open it up to the page where this was being done. Okay. And that's where I learned that the problem isn't plagiarism.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to plagiarize, please plagiarize somebody great,
yes.
not these paltry people.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm familiar with that process in one's childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So did you also go to St. Therese?
I did not go to St.
Therese. Didn't go to St. Therese?
No. So
you came straight to Newman?
I came straight to Newman.
So how old were you?
I would have been 20.
Wow.
Yes, I think so. I had a couple of gap years. Our home life was so rich. And, you know, early on in our homeschooling days, we didn't know many homeschooling families because there weren't many Catholic homeschooling families in Saskatoon.
Yeah.
So we had our, you know, our five that we knew of. And they kind of, I think, helped Mom get off the ground. We did lots of activities with them at the time. So there was a community there from the beginning. But then as the years went on, we really developed a much larger, stronger community. Through the Latin Mass mostly, which was the parish that we moved to.
Oh, you went to a parish with a Latin Mass?
Yes.
How did that come about?
It was as a result of these other issues in our parish. Mom and Dad had the perspective that we should try to improve and you know, give what we could to our current parish, our older Novus Ordo parish. And so for a long time, we were working to develop, you know, great culture events there. We were having feast day parties and asking Father for special masses for things and trying to kind of round out the faith there, so to speak, so that it wasn't just the liturgy, but it was a whole way of living, and that was our community, and we were receiving intellectual formation there and spiritual and liturgical. And, you know, having all of those different aspects of the person fed and having it, you know, appropriate so that a child could walk in and understand this is our life. This isn't just a special thing that we do, you know, once a week.
Do you think the priest understood this?
I don't know how involved he was, to be honest.
See. Okay.
The parish council was active, and so we were going mm-hmm. through them to kind of...
So you wanted A thicker experience of the faith, a thicker liturgical life.
Yes.
You wanted, I mean, if this is appropriate way of speaking about it, you wanted to have some society and culture that also was Catholic and steeped in the faith.
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. So we tried that for a while, and it was getting more and more difficult. It just wasn't really taking off, and sitting through Sunday Mass was getting harder. And I think Mom and Dad were getting a clearer perspective of the repercussions of if your liturgical life is not all that it could be, how that's informing your children's vision of the faith and what it is. And so I think they had been drawn to the Latin Mass for some time.
What drew them?
I think it was the reverence of the liturgy and the seriousness with which that community approached it. Because for that community, the faith was much more integrated in their lives. In a way that we could see, you know. I mean, I loved our old parishioners at our old parish, and I think that they had probably very serious spiritual lives. But as an older congregation, that would have looked different than how it looked for our community at the Latin Mass, because everyone was having young families, and all the moms and dads were very invested in bringing the faith home.
Mm.
And that looks different for children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, teaching children how to pray is obviously a huge thing, but there are other dimensions to how you make the faith come alive for a child.
When did you start going to the Latin Mass?
It was in 2015.
How old were you?
So I was 14.
You were 14?
Mm-hmm.
How did you like Latin?
I loved it. I had been studying it.
Oh, had you?
So that was part of our our classical curriculum. And so I think that helped. I think that I was drawn in by the beauty of the language and the mystery of the Mass.
But is it sung?
It was sung, yes.
Largely sung.
Mm-hmm. On Sundays and feasts, yeah. Although I liked the mystery and the beauty of the language, even if I didn't understand it, it was helpful that, you know, I could follow along in a missal. And we had wonderful resources for this. I mean, you can, if you know the Mass,
mm-hmm.
you can understand what's going on, because, you know, if
sure.
you attend weekly, you understand the English, and then the same.
Well, it becomes part of your memory.
That's right.
Yeah.
But then I found a greater richness in the liturgy as well, in being able to, you know, with my little bit of Latin, see, oh, there are connections here that aren't really obvious if you only ever hear the English. Like, this word is a rich word being used. And mm-hmm. it kind of opens up a lot more depth and beauty and more mystery too. So you know, in a way, the knowledge, it's strange, but the little bit of knowledge of Latin that I had, you might think that, oh, then the Mass was less mysterious to you, but really I feel like it opened up the mystery to me and showed me how impenetrable it is.
Yeah, you make a very important distinction. People often think mystery is something that's secretive, or
mm-hmm.
just because you don't understand it somehow or other, it caters to your aesthetic preoccupations. But of course, mystery really means, certainly within religious life, and I think this is what you're also gesturing towards here, where a word speaks to you, but it is not exhausted in the speaking.
Mm-hmm.
It opens up a world of connections.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the ethos of the liturgy, this Latin Mass, you've used the word reverence a couple of times. And I've talked with some of the other students about this as well. And what all of them have said to me is that the ethos is completely shaped by reverence
mm-hmm.
in the Latin Mass and within English Masses that they've experienced. It's not that they were irreverent, at least that's my sense from listening to them, but it would appear there wasn't the weight of reverence.
Mm-hmm.
and the rhythms of reverence in quite the same way.
Mm-hmm. I think it is tied to the mystery dimension of the Mass, because the thing that's special about the reverence of the Latin Mass is that you notice that there's something going on because of the postures and the prayers and just the attention of the priest and the congregation, because of the music and all of these things. There's no way that you can miss the fact that something unusual and exceptional is happening.
And you think you can when it's done in English?
I think it's easier to.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So you're 20. And what was the motivation? What was going on in your family that leads you to think that maybe you needed to go abroad?
So going to Newman was a very natural next step for me. I can see that now. It was a great next step for a continuation of my classical education, to be immersed in the liberal arts in a college setting. It was a safe move in terms of I was coming. We knew a few families here, and we trusted the program. It's not so far from home. But this is all in retrospect. So my parents had the wisdom to see this, and I had never wanted to go to college. And in the midst of my decision to go to college, I still had absolutely zero desire. In fact, I had quite a bit of... I fought against the idea rather hard. So I had my two gap years. I was teaching piano. I was living at home. I was immersing myself in our family life. I was continuing my education because the intellectual side of our community is very strong and beautiful, and so there were more opportunities than I could take advantage of from you know, college level professors who would be teaching high school students and me and grown-ups all in one class. But it was good quality
what sort
education.
Of things?
We had
just illustrate for me.
Yeah. So we had a literature class from my aunt, who's a literature professor.
Mm.
Literature, grammar. We had logic classes. We had...
What did you read in the literature class?
Oh, we had so many years of literature class because this was through my elementary and high school as well.
Uh-huh.
And it's continuing. And it's currently there are sometimes 80 people going to these classes,
wow.
Parents and children. So we would read a lot of poetry. We read some ancients. We read some Platonic dialogues. We read Chaucer. We read Shakespeare. We read Dickens. Every year we would follow a chronological structure. So we would do something ancient, something medieval, something Renaissance, something modern. We would read short stories, Flannery O'Connor.
Mm.
We read so many things.
Marvelous.
Yes. And my aunt is such an amazing teacher. And we were so blessed by that. So.
And you did logic?
Logic, yes. We followed Peter Kreef's textbook that I then repeated when I came to Newman, which is an excellent book, so I was happy to do it again, but it certainly gave me a leg up. We also had a St. Thomas Aquinas class. It was every other week, and I did that for 3 years. We were reading the Summa, and it's funny for me to look back on now because I now have such a great affection for St. Thomas and the Summa. And when I think about, you know, the goods of my college education, that's what I think of first. And when I think about wanting to read more now that I'm not in school, I want to read St. Thomas. But at the time, for those 3 years, every time we had to recommit to the class on a yearly basis, I couldn't figure out why I was taking it because I felt like I was getting absolutely nothing out of it.
Mm.
But obviously, it was laying the groundwork for those mm-hmm. philosophic concepts, because I came to Newman and you know what words like potency and act mean. And it was then that I really started to appreciate St. Thomas, and I could breeze through an article and understand what he was saying. And then once you get, you know, the basic argument, then you can actually then it becomes a fruitful experience after that.
You can think about it.
That's right.
Yeah.
So those were the main ones. I'm sure there were others as well.
And that was in your high school years?
Yes.
And then the two gap years.
Mm-hmm.
And that is done by this community of homeschoolers?
That's right, yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Largely centering around the Latin Mass, but definitely extending beyond it. Mm-hmm. Especially in recent years. You know, we now have a fair number of Protestants who come, especially to my aunt's classes. We have a big community of people from the Orthodox community in Saskatoon. So it's actually really beautiful to see lots of people are recognizing the goods.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good for us, you know. It's beautiful to come together in that way.
So you resisted coming to Newman.
I resisted.
But you found yourself there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you knew a few people there.
That's right, yes.
So how did that first year speak to you?
My first year was a year of intellectual progress, I guess, and not much else. So I think the good of that year was I immersed myself in what I was doing. I was in survival mode. And so I think I studied. I've done the math on it. I think I was studying 12 hours a day and 8 hours on Saturdays. Sundays I took off, so that was why I maintained my sanity to some extent, I think. But the difficulty with that year was that it was a COVID year. And so my class was extremely small. There were three girls in my class, and then we had two boys who were not seminarians, and then we had we started off with about 6 to 8 seminarians.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a small class. The seminarians had their community at the seminary, which is appropriate. And then the three girls and the two boys, we needed to figure out a way to make our own community. The difficulty being that none of us wanted to be at the college because it was very silent and dark. I actually think, like in my remembrances of the college that year, I actually wonder whether they just didn't turn the lights on, because everything about that year in my memory is gray and quiet. and people, yeah, we didn't want to be necessarily at the college. We couldn't go to restaurants. It was winter, so we could have gone and sat in a snowbank, but we weren't that. We didn't have a lot of movers and shakers in our class, so those kind of fun and creative solutions didn't necessarily come up that year. So I think that's why it was such an intellectual year for me. It wasn't a very balanced year, and yet it was, again, it was a difficult year. But again, in retrospect, it was a really beautiful year because I didn't know that I loved the intellectual tradition. And it was beautiful to discover that. And I made so many connections that year. Our courses were so well integrated. And I really came to love my classes and my readings and the authors whom we read.
Who did you read that year? What were the courses and who did you read?
We had a philosophy course that was a historical introduction, so we hit, you know, every philosopher from Plato to, I think we maybe read Benedict the 16th at the end, over our 2 semesters of that course. That was a difficult course. I didn't enjoy it at the time, but I'm grateful for it now.
Was that Dr. Fast?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Then we had Catholic Studies with Dr. Topping.
How was that shaped?
It was an amazing course. That was my favorite course. It was shaped around representative writings that gave a picture of Catholicism in a chronological order. So we did read lots of the saints' writings. We read St. Therese's Story of a Soul. We read letters of the North American martyrs, the Jesuits. We read documents from the Council of Trent. We read some of Luther. We read, what did we have in first semester? Oh, we read the Confessions. It was full of rich literature. It was a beautiful introduction. And again, very integrated. It was that class that I think, that there was lots of crossover in different classes, but that class, I think, did the best job of pulling everything together. Like we were looking at little vignettes of art and history and architecture and music.
And thought.
And thought all put together. Mm-hmm. So that was a beautiful course. And it had a lovely, lovely setup. It was, I don't mean this in any kind of belittling way, but it's, I could almost compare it best to a kindergarten classroom, which was just what we needed, because I think the struggle for some of my other classes was it felt like we walked into the classroom and our professors forgot that we were, you know, lots of us straight out of high school and that we'd been in the university system for years. But in that class, it was all broken up into little chunks. So we had recitations at the beginning of class, and so we had certain recitations that were set out for us or that we could choose. We memorized Psalm 1, so you would memorize your recitation and then you'd go up and recite it. And there wasn't a lot of, it wasn't a very demanding exercise, but it was so valuable. And if you haven't learned to memorize things in your earlier education, then the first year of university is a great time to do that.
That's right, yeah.
And it's beautiful then as a class, you then have a collective memory and things that you all know like the back of your hand.
So that was during COVID too?
That was during COVID too.
But it worked a little bit different for you.
How so?
Well, you speak about it as with enjoyment and not with the kind of darkness that tended to characterize that period.
I think I was not relaxed that year. And I think I was perhaps projecting that other people had very high expectations of me, particularly people that we knew from home. And so then that made it very difficult for me to enter into it. So I could do very well academically, and I pushed myself really hard because I think, I don't know if it was because of the expectations or why exactly, but it wasn't that was fun per se. Like, I remember it with enjoyment because our class had the most bonding in that Catholic Studies course, because we would have group time then and we would go around and discuss our favorite lines from the text. So it just made it easy to enter into the Socratic method to get to know the class a little bit. So it was pedagogically, it worked really well. But it wasn't like my later years of attending class where I really looked forward to class and where class was the highlight of my academics. At this time, reading was my highlight, and I would read at home, and then I would steel myself up to go to the college.
Well, it was a combination of things, I suspect, both COVID, but also you left home.
Yes, so there were lots of changes.
And because your home was such a rich world, leaving it is not easy.
And that's why I didn't want to go. I didn't see the need.
Yeah. But your parents did.
Yes.
In all likelihood.
They did, for sure, yes.
One of the real challenges, I think, of being a parent, I've thought about this a little bit, is how do we initiate our children to the culture and the faith, but also how do we initiate them to the world?
Yes.
To that which is beyond our ken. And I think we haven't done nearly enough thinking about it, how that works.
Well, and it's very different for different children.
Oh, yeah. And every child needs to be taken in their particularity. Otherwise, it's abuse.
Yes.
So that first year, you survived it.
I survived it.
You took some things from it.
Mm-hmm.
And then things shifted.
Well, I had a firm resolution that regardless of what anybody said or any of my own opinions to the contrary, I would not go back.
Ah, great.
And
so you went home in the spring with that?
And I had to recover myself. I didn't have many draws to go back because I hadn't formed friendships there. Not really, really good friendships like I have from Newman now. And so, you know, had I had that, I think whatever other difficulties were there would have been secondary. In the end, the reason I went back was because it was for the same reasons that I decided to go in the first place, because I didn't initially go for an intellectual formation as the top goal. So that's what I had received the first year, but all of the other goods that I think my parents had hoped that I would gain that year hadn't exactly been achieved. And so because no other opportunities for, you know, achieving those goals had opened up over the course of the summer, the thing to do was to go back and try again and just hope that I could get my feet under me and, you know, learn how to have joy in those situations and develop the friendships and the community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I was a rather serious child. Like, the things that I most genuinely enjoyed were when I was given responsibility, and I loved the structure of our family routine. And mom in particular was always finding amazing, fun opportunities for us in terms of just learning different skills or going on ski trips or all these things. And I was always pushing back against that because what I wanted, the thing I loved, was my school routine. And what I wanted more of was fewer interruptions to that. So, you know, I was rather serious. And I think that's one thing that I've learned from Newman, but not in my first year, was it's fun to have fun. Fun made me uncomfortable when I was a child. So, you know, I think it's probably a temperament thing. But I have to say, it's enjoyable now.
That's great.
So that was a beautiful thing that, you know, I needed rounding out. And that's one of the ways that I was rounded out, I think. And so I went back to find, I mean, I don't know if I exactly knew what I was looking for, but went back because there weren't really other good options of what I should be doing with my life. So you continue what you started. And then that year, things fell into place a lot more. We weren't all masked up, so I could see my classmates' faces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That helped a lot. Mm-hmm. The seminarians would be around because it wasn't COVID, so they didn't have to rush back to the seminary. We were allowed to sit with whoever we wanted to, not just with our household. And then the second years had come, because I was in the first year of the BA had been the year before me, and then that was a smaller year, and that was all seminarians. Then my year came with the, I don't know, 13 or 15 of us. Our numbers changed, obviously, over time, but... And then the next year came, and there was a large class of really great people. and they weren't seminarians, and there were no seminarians in that year. And I think that made a big difference. Simply because they were people moving to Edmonton who didn't already have a main community there. And so...
And when you go into the seminary... you really become an intimate part of a cohort.
That's right.
And it's pretty tightly woven.
That's right, yeah.
For obvious reasons and necessary reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I see what you mean, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're not seeking to build up a different... If you're seeking to build a community, you're seeking to build the seminary community.
Right. Yeah.
And you'd be wrong to do otherwise. Yeah. I mean, if you have extra energy, you know, many of the seminarians do really contribute to the college community, and that's such a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, they have to have their priorities straight. And so it was lovely having this class come in, and they were looking to make the college their community. And so then, you know, things, it wasn't instantaneous by any means, but things started to happen. So that was a big step in the right direction for me, to meet new people and, you know, start forming some beautiful friendships and just having good discussions around the college. That hadn't really happened the year before.
I see.
To any large extent.
So you graduated last year.
Yes.
So that's, what is it, 8 months ago or something like that?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
10 months ago. When you look back on it, and I appreciate you telling me about that first year, because I had no idea how that, of course, it worked out for you. And it's wonderful that you came back, that you decided to face that. Give me a little sense of how you saw the curriculum, the coursework unfold. Let me just say a few things from my perspective, and you can just build on that if you wish.
Mm-hmm.
I was delighted to see that here was a program that was going to really give young people an opportunity to read the great literature of the West.
Mm-hmm.
There is great literature in other civilizations as well. And my own view of the great books is that they include, I mean, my view, my list of the great books includes, not many, but several books from Africa and China and Japan as well. There's even one associated with indigenous people on it, my little list. So here was a program which had at its center the true, the good, and the beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
This was a stated preoccupation. The development of a historical, a philosophical, an artistic stream using primary work, mostly, and seeking a Socratic method, the opportunity to read and talk and think, also to be able to develop your thought, engage others in thinking. So that great books approach, I was delighted to see that this was being done. The other thing that was very striking in the classroom, the bit I had the opportunity to be in the classroom, was to see the synergy between classes and over the term and over several terms. That was so striking to me and so unusual. I mean, I've taught in universities for 40-some years. So, I mean, it was very, very striking. But from your perspective, just speak a little bit about how this worked for you, or how it addressed you, or what you draw from it.
I think it was an amazing way of learning for me, reading the great books rather than the textbook. It was difficult at first, because you have to understand, like, I remember reading dialogues at the beginning of our philosophy class, and a dialogue was the trickiest thing you could read, because you had to figure out who was saying what and what was actually being argued and if anything was even being concluded or not. And then I remember reading dialogues much later on, and you looked at it as a relief from the modern philosophers who you were trying to wade through.
Well, and I mean, Plato's descriptions, they are drinking copious quantities of wine.
Yes.
As they talk as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there might be some muddying there, but ultimately it was so wonderful to get to know the author from the author. And, you know, I would love to study more philosophy, but I feel like the philosophy that I have, I'm very confident in because I fought for it. Like, we really had to try to decipher what's being said here, and does this line up with, you know, the modern catchphrase about Descartes or Hume or whomever? Or do we disagree with, like, is the catchphrase that people remember him by, you know, you can understand why people have it, but it needs to be nuanced to be properly understood. And I have an affection for all of these authors, who lots of whom I disagree with. You know, we read lots of I would say, problematic philosophers in that Introduction to Philosophy class, and I do look back really fondly on them because, you know, there was a real battle to figure out what they were saying, and but we had the most rewarding little assignments that, again, were so difficult in the beginning, but we had to write one paragraph on each author, and it was usually on their central idea. And those were really difficult for me to write. but in the end, it was something that I used a lot, and it's what I, my biggest takeaway that just remains in my mind. But I used it in my future writing because there was always a little gem of a quotation from that author, and then my own little expose on it. And so I ended up spending a long time on all of those little paragraph assignments on each author. But when I go back and read them, they're some of the nicest writing that I've done. Like, they were beautiful. And then I was able to, you know, use that as a springboard for future projects and really have the thought of that author condensed down, which is helpful because then when you think of them, it's very easy to compare and contrast, and then you figure, oh, this would make for a great essay if I'm trying to compare and contrast two things. I'm going to go from here and then go deeper into that philosopher's thought, but know that I'm very confident in what the central tenet is.
The other word that is striking in what you say is that you developed a real appreciation for all of them. A kind of fondness.
Yes.
So it's wonderful, isn't it, to be fond of people, to have glimpsed them enough that you can be fond of them even though you disagree with them deeply.
Yes.
In some cases. But they're remarkable people who have furnished our landscape. So it's a sad thing to my mind when education becomes argument. When it becomes simply an occasion for proofing or for some ideological party. Alfred North Whitehead, who, according to Yaroslav Pelikan, was the brightest human being ever to walk the campus at Princeton University, or on American ground, in his little book, The Aims of Education, talks about the first aim of education being romance. You need to fall in love with the discipline, with its sources. And that's something that takes some time. And I think the way you've described it, reading these texts, struggling with them, seeking to distill what's at least part of the heart of the matter here, and going away, this really speaks well of the teaching you were given, walking away from it with a fondness for these people. That is a beautiful, beautiful thing. Whitehead then says that the next aim of education is, I can't remember the term he uses, but some depth and texture. And then the third aim of education is analysis, not critique, analysis. Whereas in so much of our education, we flipped it around. I know people that have gotten PhDs in philosophy at the U of A that have never read Plato, but they've read articles criticizing bits and pieces of Plato. It gives you a different sense of the world. And that's what's so striking to me, having a sense of the world and having a sense of the tradition as belonging to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of these great writers and artists, we stand on their shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing we stand on our on their shoulders is a wonderful thing.
Yes.
As opposed to not knowing,
mm-hmm.
and not realizing they were human beings,
mm-hmm.
that were trying to make their way in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so I think the beautiful thing for me was this sense of discovery. I don't think I would appreciate my education as I do now if it hadn't been a great books education, because I don't think there would have been the same kind of discovery. If you're reading a textbook and just being spoon-fed, this is what this author thought, and this is where his thought can be seen in modern culture, you don't have the satisfaction of working through ideas and then of coming to these realizations yourself. So there's this interesting interplay between, you know, standing on the shoulders of others, but then needing to figure it out yourself and not be spoon-fed it.
And having them reduced to an argument.
That's right.
Or reduced to an idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I call the tradition. An education in the tradition is to become fond of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And to get a sense of having encountered them.
Mm-hmm.
Not simply mind their argument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's beautifully spoken, Anna. So another aspect of the education, at least as I think I saw it at Newman, there is this aspect we've been chatting about a little bit, which I would call the love of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the aspect of the desire for God. I take those phrases from a book by the great Benedictine scholar, Dom Jean Leclerc, who wrote a wonderful book called The Love of Learning and the Desire for God on Medieval Monastic Culture.
Mm.
But it's a beautiful phrase. And the other thing that I glimpsed at Newman was because there's the cohort that you were part of, many of those young people were serious about their faith. And so as such serious about their learning, but they were also very committed to spiritual discipline,
mm-hmm.
to the liturgy,
mm-hmm.
to the office of the church,
mm-hmm.
To song, to chant,
mm-hmm.
to learning to sing together. How did that work for you?
I would say that there are two things very easy to pinpoint that I experienced and came to love mostly, I think, for really the first time that year, and both through the college. The first was the Divine Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which we had at the college on Thursdays instead of Mass. And that was really, really... it was very helpful for me. It was the combination of discovering the Divine Liturgy and the different things we'd been talking about in our Way of Beauty course with Mr. Bryce and in other courses as well was very helpful for answering some of the questions I'd been having about the liturgy. So really being able to step in that liturgy and just be immersed in the beauty of it, and still recognizing that in that liturgy, they do some things exactly the opposite way that we do. Like, they stand.
Through all.
rather than, you know, kneeling to reverence the Blessed Sacrament. So, obviously, there's a significance behind that. They're not doing it out of disrespect. There's a tradition of Our Lady standing at the foot of the cross, and they follow after her in that regard, as far as I understand. So anyways, coming up against these questions of, okay, well, if I'm in Divine Liturgy, it seems to be that I should do as they do. And certainly it wasn't hard for me to love it and to trust their liturgical sense because it resonated with many of the things that I had come to know and love about the Roman liturgy. And so that experience just helped answer some questions about, you know, what are legitimate differences in the liturgy, where, you know, that these differences are often okay. I mean, there are certainly abuses that are not okay.
There are abuses within each of liturgical families.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be between them too.
Yes. Yeah. So it just helped sort out some issues for me in that way. So that was, yeah, very actually foundational, and it's been very helpful going forward. I also, and this was separate from the college, but that year I also discovered the Ordinariate, which is the Anglican use of the church. So in 2000, actually I don't know what year, but very, very recently, Pope Benedict invited any Anglicans who wanted to come into communion with Rome and to maintain their liturgy or most of it. You know, a few slight changes were made, but they retained the beautiful English that they had been using, the translations of the liturgy. They retained some of the beautiful prayers that only occur for the Catholic Church in their liturgy because they were born out of the Anglican tradition. And they're gorgeous prayers. They're so rich. And so I discovered that liturgy as well in my first year at the college. And that was another, I would say, like, there was a three-pronged three-pronged approach to why I was able to process and develop a more mature liturgical sense than I had before. And the Ordinariate was part of that as well.
So this is the Anglican parishes. Sometimes they were whole parishes.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Anglican priests who were then ordained in the Roman Catholic priesthood, married with their families.
Yes.
And that has added a whole dimension to Roman Catholic liturgical life. The language of Cramer and King James is the height of English language.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not surprised to hear you say that. So does that, just to glance back, the Ordinariate with that reverential English language. I mean, I'm not meaning to compare here, but is it the reverence that is carried by that language that also is not unlike what was carried by the Latin Mass for you?
Yes. Yes, it was. I also loved, there were things that I found in the Ordinariate that I still feel are perhaps somewhat lacking in the Latin Mass today. And now this may be something that's more particular to, you know, specific Latin Mass parishes and specific Ordinariate parishes, because my experience of them is, you know, not extremely wide. But, you know, through our Way of Beauty class and studying different documents on sacred music, and, you know, we discussed Vatican II a fair bit in that class, it seems like there were legitimate difficulties that the council tried to address. Now, whether the council addressed them well or poorly, and whether they were enacted well or poorly, is, you know, another question. But when I went to the Ordinariate, all the things that I think the council did rightly try to address, you know, to round out the people's understanding of the faith, because our understanding of the faith comes from our experience of the liturgy. So the Second Vatican Council was trying to round out our experience of the faith, perhaps, and answer some real, you know, imbalances, perhaps, or balance things out. And those things are, in my mind, done so well in the Ordinariate. You know, the issue of the vernacular, there is an importance to the congregation knowing what's going on. That's not to say that that can't happen in Latin. And there's a beauty to Latin as the sacred language of the church.
Sure.
But the elevation of the language in the Ordinariate, I think, still allows for, you know, this is a special language, and it's language that we're speaking to God in. And yet we can more easily take it on our lips. So there's an accessibility that you know, perhaps has been helpful for the portion of the church that attends that liturgy. At the ordinariate here in Edmonton, all the people chant all the propers.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very much what the church wants us to do. The church mm-hmm. wants us to take on our own lips the word of God, because that's Christ. And the propers are drawn from the word of God. So just a lot of beautiful customs, and I don't know how universal they are, but for me it was just, very salutary in a lot of different ways, spiritually and intellectually, you know, figuring things out as well.
And in the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, I mean, it's de rigueur for the whole congregation to chant everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
I mean, there is priestly, deacon elements,
mm-hmm.
but in general, this is the prayer of the church.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been periods in the Eastern churches, both Eastern Rite Catholics as well as Orthodox, where choirs have taken over
mm-hmm.
and robbed the congregation of the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's beautiful choirs and there's a role for all that, but one of the vivid things to me is that this is the prayer of the people of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jewish creed is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." We need to hear.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to hear what we are saying as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, that's interesting. What's the ordinariate parish here in Edmonton?
It is St. Benedict's.
St. Benedict.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I believe I was also going to tell you about a second experience of the liturgy, though. And that was that we began praying the office of readings once or twice a week at the college. The seminarians would lead it, so it was a beautiful gift to the lay students because we wouldn't have been doing it otherwise. We would do it at the college chapel. And
it was the office of readings.
Yes.
You do that after lunch?
Yes, sometimes after class, actually. Anyways, it would adjust depending on our semester schedule, but I said that I was not very relaxed that year. And those moments when we would pray the office of readings, which was new to me, were some of the few moments in the week where I would actually just let the tension go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And somehow, obviously, God gives us what we need in different seasons of our lives. And I didn't feel like I was receiving a lot in prayer that year in general, with the exception of when we would pray mm-hmm. the office of readings. Somehow, every time we would pray it, the entire thing would be exactly what I needed to hear. Or there would be so many phrases mm-hmm. that I felt like it was too rich, and I wanted to hold on to them because I was looking for lifelines. But yet there was so much richness in it for me, I couldn't even keep track of all the places that I wanted to remember to go back to. So that was a beautiful gift. Yeah.
Well, the office is an amazing cycle of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And the office of readings itself is just masterful. So not quite sure how to ask this, and maybe it's inappropriate to even ask it. What are you taking with you from these years at Newman as you walk in the world?
A lot of things that I think can be summed up by saying that I feel liberal now.
You feel?
Liberal.
Liberal.
Liberal-minded. Not
liberal-minded.
Not liberal necessarily in a political sense, but...
Liberal-minded. You feel liberal-minded.
And
so walk around that. Tell me about that.
I imagine that this is the purpose of a liberal arts education. I feel like I'm much more at ease with myself in the world because I have a framework, and I've seen portions of it through the authors whom I've read and the people I've discussed with. And so it allows me a greater liberty to speak with people and read without feeling like I need to hold tight to what I know is true, because I don't know how to assess anything that's not exactly what I've been taught.
Mm.
I don't know if that makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
Okay. So, and that freedom of, you know, not being stressed about holding on to something, I think has led to, yeah, a greater ease and a lot more enjoyment of the world. I think that my eyes have been opened to the beauty of the world in a way that they weren't before. I didn't grow up afraid of the world by any means, although, you know, our family life was, you know, carefully prepared for us in a certain sense. But part of that careful preparation was not a complete sheltering. Mom and Dad were very intentional about what we were exposed to,
mm-hmm.
but they were very motivated to have us integrated, not just in the parish community, say, but also in other civil communities,
mm-hmm.
which I think was important.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't afraid of the world before, but now it's not threatening. I'm not really worried by it. And I think that's partly because I have greater understanding of what I believe and why I believe it. And I can see, I can trace trends of trends of ideas in history. And also I can understand more readily how easy it is to hold various opinions. I have, I think, a greater understanding for, you know, you begin with a premise that's true, but you take it in one certain way, and then you run with it. And it's so easy for the truth to go off track.
One of the great values of a liberal education, and I see this as you talk about it, is that because you have been in the presence of all these remarkable human beings, as you've encountered them, and because you've become fond of them,
mm-hmm.
in their differences.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair of me to suggest that that means when you see difference in our own world now, that A, it doesn't frighten you,
mm-hmm.
B, one perhaps has a bit of humility,
mm-hmm.
because one realizes how complicated
mm-hmm.
things are, the way they've worked out. But the key here, in what I heard you say, I can't recall the word you used, is delight.
Mm-hmm.
A sense of the wonder and delight of the world.
Yes.
And the wonder and delight of other human beings,
mm-hmm.
with all their foolishness, all their mm-hmm. missteps, and all their struggle.
Mm-hmm.
That is a liberal education.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Anna.
Thank you, Dr. Gola.
Thank you for joining us. Anna's keen and sharp mind and her gracious and playful spirit animated each class I was privileged to teach that she attended. Through her encounter with the great books and the Socratic method, as she has said, several key changes occurred for her. She became fond of each of the authors, including those with whom she disagrees. She got to know the authors from engaging them through their primary work. Her eyes opened to the beauty of the world, including the beauty of those who differ from her and her community of faithful. The living tradition of the dead is larger than all of our ideological fraternities. Anna's serious disposition from childhood remains. It has grown to include delight. This is the fruit of all that is best in a liberal education on proper ground. I welcome your comments on the various themes in this podcast and invite you to visit our website. Contact details may be found in the program notes.